You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Ooh, it's time to probe the universe on Spaced Out, thanks to the spunky spunks at Stardome Observatory and Planetarium in One Tree Hill.
Spaced Out.
Good morning, David. How are you going this Easter weekend?
Oh, not too bad, Alice. Not too many Easter eggs just yet.
But hopefully soon.
Well, I don't know. I don't need them, I have to say.
Yeah, it always seems like, I don't know, I guess it's just an excuse to have a lot of chocolate.
Well, you know, when the kids were young, then they ate them all. But, yeah, the sort of reason for them goes when they go. So, yeah, they have kids, I guess I'll be getting them as a grandparent.
I've always been a fan of waiting till just after Easter to get some. I think even when I was young, I was still practical enough to be pro that strategy.
Get them on sale.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough.
So what are we looking at today?
I thought we'd start off with an announcement the other day that there's a possibility of alien life on one of the moons of Saturn. The Cassini spacecraft has been orbiting Saturn for over 10 years. It's been doing a wonderful job, but its mission is coming to end later this year, and we'll talk about that at the end of the year. But what it did a couple of years ago was went very, very close to one of its moons called Enceladus. This moon is just outside the visible rings that we can see in photographs and so on, and it's quite small. And so what the Cassini mission has done is, in the end of its time there, making more and more dangerous orbits, so dangerous to the spacecraft, that is. So it's actually going to go between the rings, inside the rings, and down the track, something that's avoided like the plague up till now.
What are the rings actually made of?
Hundreds of thousands of lumps of rock and ice.
So pretty dangerous to move through.
Well, absolutely, and with the speeds they're travelling at, the ring material in the closest ring to the planet's travelling at about 80,000 kilometres an hour.
Wow.
So, I mean, the spacecraft going in through there will be going at a similar speed, if not faster. So if you came across one coming the other way, then yeah, it'll be curtained straight away. So anyway, they discovered these geysers of water spurting out of cracks of this moon called Enceladus. It was a couple of years ago. And so what they, well, before that, but a couple of years ago, they actually flew through one of those geysers. So that's really close to this moon. This moon's about 500 kilometers in size. Just keep in mind what we're talking about. Saturn is 1.5 billion kilometers away. Okay, so all this is happening at a huge distance away. So it flew through this geyser in 2015, the end of 2015. It takes a long time for them to analyze the data, come up with hypotheses about what it all means, discuss it with their colleagues, go through the peer review and all the rest. So it's been a long process, and what they've come up with is something that we see on Earth, and that is the possibility of hot magma, hot rock meeting cold oceanic water at the bottom of an ocean. Since that those flybys, they knew that Enceladus has a very thick ice crust, so it doesn't have a solid rocky surface. It's ice about 30 to 40 kilometers deep, thick, and below that there's an ocean. And the reason they know that ocean covers pretty much the whole planet underneath that ice is because of wobbles in the way the planet, the moon is moving. So that ice crust seems to be floating on an ocean, and that ocean is 25 to 30 kilometers deep. If you think that our Earth's oceans are an average of less than 4 kilometers deep, it's a significant amount of water. What they also found in that geyser wasn't just water ice, but they found hydrogen, just hydrogen, molecular hydrogen all by itself. And that's the key, interpreting what that is. And there was a surfeit of it. It wasn't the amount they expected. There was more coming out than they expected, which means something must be producing it in those geysers. And so the best model I've come up with is that at the bottom of these oceans, this hot rock that's interacting with the water and probably organic compounds as well. It's producing this hydrogen and on an ongoing basis, and so it's pumping it out. Now, if you've got hydrogen, that can combine with carbon dioxide and other things, and so you produce methane and other organic materials that life can be sustained with. It's going to be, without the use of light, it's going to be so dark down there, sunlight won't reach there. So this would provide a source of energy, a source of power to life that could be down there. So it's not saying there is life down there, but this is a good indication that there could be life down there.
Wow, that's so interesting. Is this kind of the most likely place we've discovered so far? For life, I mean.
Probably the second. The first is one of the moons of Jupiter called Europa. That has even deeper ocean. Its ice crust is 10 to 30 kilometres deep and an ocean 100 kilometres deep. The volume of water on Europa is 2 to 3 times more water than we've got on Earth. It's a huge amount, even though Europa is only about 3,000 kilometres in diameter, half the diameter of Earth. So Europa, in fact, they figure it even more so. Being around Jupiter, which has more gravity, it's got more chance of producing the energy that could be required. So, in fact, there are two missions that are going to go to Europa. One's called Europa Clipper, which is like low flybys. That will be launched about 2022. It was going to have a little detachable lander, a bit like Cassini had the Huygens probe that went down to Titan. But that's now developed into a completely separate mission. So there's a Europa lander mission, which is looking like it might be launched sort of the mid-2020s, about 2025, 27, something like that. So a lander going down to the surface, whether it has something it drills down through the crust to get to the ocean, who knows. But, so they are looking at a Europa as well.
And when they say life, I mean, what are they sort of hypothesizing is
bacterial.
Would be there? Bacterial life.
Yeah, simple life. The sort of thing where, I mean, some models, some ideas of the beginning of life here is that it could have started off down the bottom of the oceans. Production of methanogenesis could be where life started on Earth, or it could have started in volcanoes, but we don't know.
Very cool. Okay, let's move on. We're looking at black holes.
Yes, well, to see a black hole is a bit tricky because nothing comes out of them, no light, no energy, nothing. So the best you're going to be able to do if you want to get a photo of one is to see a silhouette. But that's extremely difficult. So what they're aiming to do is, what they've actually just finished doing is looking at one black hole. That's the one at the center of our galaxy. Galaxies have supermassive black holes. The one in the middle of the Milky Way is about 4 million solar masses, so 4 million times the weight of the Sun, and it's about 26,000 light years away. One light year being 9.5 trillion kilometers. So it's a huge distance away, but it's the closest really big one. And the idea is to have a look at that with radio telescopes. With radio telescopes, you can combine the light, I mean, radio waves are a form of light, across the globe, and so they're linking together a whole bunch of radio telescopes from the South Pole, Chile, Mexico, the United States, Hawaii, and Spain. And by combining the information from these radio telescopes, it creates a telescope pretty much as wide as the Earth, which means it's got a lot of resolution. But to do it, it all has to be done within about a week. They all do it at exactly the same time. Each of these telescopes will record about 500 terabytes of data in the observing period. So that's too much data to send by internet. So it's literally collected on hard drives and then fly the hard drives to a computing center in the States. And that is basically what amounts to a supercomputer, and it spends months and months combining all that information together to come up with an image. So although they've done the observation, it's going to be months before any image actually is likely to come out. And they also have to wait the South Pole one. They can't get that data out until they can get a plane down there to fly it out. So that won't arrive until September or October. So
after winter has passed.
Yeah. It's a long process, but, you know, what they can do is combine that, and that's one good thing about radio astronomy. You don't have to just get a photo straight away, and hopefully come up with an image of the black hole, the centre of our galaxy.
Awesome. Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, let's move to Jupiter.
Jupiter, people have known about the Great Red Spot for a very long time. It's been observed continuously since about 1830, and it's thought to have been seen for the first time sometime after Galileo, around the 1670s or somewhere around there, although not observed after that. Well, what they found is another spot. This one is a cold one. By cold, it's a couple of hundred degrees cooler than the surrounding atmosphere. It's about twice the size of the Earth, about 24,000 kilometres across and 12,000 kilometres high. And it's in the North Pole, excuse me. And what seems to be happening is the aurora on Jupiter are very, very strong. The magnetic field of Jupiter is massively powerful. The aurora is fed by gases from the volcanic moon Io, and those aurora cool the atmosphere. And this spot seems to be the result of that. So this is a high cloud, high atmospheric phenomenon. The Great Red Spot is in the lower regions of the atmosphere. This is the first sort of large-scale, high atmosphere phenomenon. So, yeah, that was confirmed combining 13,000 images over 40 nights from the infrared telescope. So, yeah, a lot of information and data there to confirm what was going on there.
Interesting. Mm. Great cold spot.
Yeah, it's not the sort of thing we're about to see in a telescope, though, it's, as I said, it's cool, so it's an infrared light. The Great Red Spot, of course, you can see on a backyard telescope.
Great. Okay, let's move on to the Auckland night sky.
Night sky, after sunset, Matariki, the Pleiades, is very low down the northwest after sunset. Mars is right by it at the moment, but they're both dropping back towards the sun, so there's only a few days really left to see those. And you'll have to wait for Matariki to come up in the morning sky in June for the Matariki Festival. On the other horizon, we've got Jupiter, though. That's nice and bright. And a little later in the evening, Saturn's rising. In the morning sky, we've got Venus over in the east rising, really, really bright, and Jupiter setting over in the west. So plenty of things to have a look at.
Great. And what's happening at the Stardome?
Stardome, we've got the school holiday program. It starts after Easter. So two four-day weeks, because the second week is Anzac Day, so need to squeeze everyone in to 8 days this time. We've got a new show in the planetarium called Super Volcanoes, which discusses super volcanoes on Earth, but also goes out to the solar system, looking at volcanoes there. After looking at the night sky, the program will then move into the space room, where we've got demonstrations and activities about volcanoes, some pretty cool ones, things that go bang and so on. And then we'll go outside, see a few more demonstrations, and if the weather cooperates, we'll launch some water bottle rockets for the children before they go.
Sounds like a good time.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's $12 for the children, $10 for the parents, a little cheaper for the parents. And it's easy to book. Just get online at stardome.org.nz, or you can phone 624-1246.
Excellent. Thank you so much, David, and I hope that you enjoy the rest of your long weekend.
You too, Alice.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.